This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Bob Mondello, movie critic for All Things Considered.
Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
comedian Samantha Bee talks about the choices she offered Republicans.
Kevin Eubanks talks about leaving one of television's most high-profile music jobs.
Robert Duvall does not do his Marlon Brando impression, but first,
in the new movie, Get Him to the Greek, a recording company agent, played by Jonah Hill, is tasked with making sure a drug-addled rock star, Russell Brand, makes it from London to an L.A. concert that's supposed to be his big comeback. It's another summer buddy comedy from the sprawling Judd Apatow circle. Bob, you had this review. Let's listen.
The British rock star character in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Aldous Snow, was a bit of a monster, egotistical, arrogant, and clueless, as played by Russell Brand, and fans will be pleased to hear that he hasn't changed a bit. In Get Him to the Greek, we see the aftermath of his latest disastrous concept album about war-torn Darfur, or Zimbabwe, or Rwanda, he's not quite sure which, where he thinks he met his inner African child while doing poverty tourism.
I have crossed the mystic desert to snap pictures of the poor. I've been fighting them to brunch, let them crash out on my floor.
The album African Child may have made Aldous a joke, but music agent Aaron Green, played by Jonah Hill, thinks he has a solution. Get the rock star to do a comeback concert at the Greek Theater in L.A. This is easier said than done, of course, because Aldous has been comforting himself pretty strenuously with drugs, booze, and groupies since the debut of African Child, and is still smarting, as Aaron discovers while talking shop after finally wrestling him onto a plane from London.
It seems as if on your last album, you kind of went in the studio and just did whatever the producer asked you to do.
Right. Yeah, no, that's exactly, this is good.
It's just, you know, every artist just has one album that's just not good, and that's it. Honestly, I listen to that, and I'm just like, what was he thinking?
Ooh, too much. Way too much.
In future, if someone asks you to give them a critique of their work, don't rip out their gizzards and hold it in front of their face.
I'm sorry, look, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, what you did was very spiteful, but it was also very brave and very honest, and I respect you for doing that, but the content of what you said has made me hate you.
And 2 days still to go before the concert. Jonah Hill and Russell Brand look relaxed together, no matter what level of inebriation or awkwardness is required of them. But the movie around them goes kind of sloppy and sentimental whenever it's not being raunchy or gross. And while that's been sort of the blueprint for Judd Apatow comedies, there's a thing called diminishing returns. Apatow's producer on this one, not director, let's note, and you get a definite sense of a talented second string being given a chance to shine. The thing is, some really terrific supporting players maybe aren't cut out to be stars. A Romeo and Juliet spinoff called Mercutio and the Nurse wouldn't cut it. And the Aldous and his fan spinoff in Get Him to the Greek is a little thin, too, actors notwithstanding. Great in support, these characters can't really support a whole movie. I'm Bob Mondello.
You know, Bob, I think it's safe to say you will be the only critic to bring up Shakespeare in your review of Get Him to the Greek.
That may very well be true. It's actually a thing, though, that I've been thinking about for years, about how it's the same kind of thing as bringing the Saturday Night Live people out of their skit comedies and making them support an entire movie. It kind of doesn't work, and supporting characters shouldn't be asked to do that either, and you realize that pretty quickly in this, although they're very endearing, you know, actors to watch, the material can't sustain. So,
yeah, not everybody is good in large doses.
It's true. Well, actually, somebody who is great in as many doses as you want is Robert Duvall. When you think of him, you can't help but think of his iconic roles in movies like The Apostle and Network, not to mention his turns as Sonny in The Godfather and as Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird. Robert Siegel spoke with Duvall about Get Low, his new picture, and asked him about how he is able to say so much with his characters with so little dialogue.
I watched your new film, Get Low, and I was struck by the fact that when you're not talking, when you're listening and reacting to somebody, you're acting incredibly during.
Yeah, it's just like we're doing right now.
Yeah, we're doing right now.
When you're talking, I'm listening. And you have to treat it as if it's the first time you've ever heard it, even though you may have rehearsed it. It's difficult to do sometimes. Sometimes you can break that by doing an actual improvisation. But with the writing as very good as it was in Get Low,
yeah,
then you don't need to improvise so much. But you just try to make it like it's the first time. And sometimes, you know, the first take, that's it. Right. We don't have to do it 78 times like Stanley Kubrick did, which I don't think I could have done.
So how do you do, I mean, is there some device you have, some mental process you go through that permits you to have this exchange as if it's completely new and fresh when, in fact, you've been studying those lines?
I guess actor's faith is a thing to believe in what you're doing and to be relaxed and not have fears. I think, not that I read him that much, but Stanislavski, the great Russian guy, said, you know, there's always something in the back of your head approving what you do, as opposed to that self-conscious type of self-watchfulness. So it's that healthy, wonderful sense of something in the back of your mind observing what you're doing that makes it work.
Somehow, Robert Duvall has made it work, made it believable, even when he's played characters who were plainly over the top. From Major Frank Burns in MASH to Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore in Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
That part earned him one of his 6 Oscar nominations. He won an Oscar for his 1983 role as Max Sledge, the has-been country music singer in Tender Mercies.
You see, I don't trust happiness. I never did, I never will.
I asked Robert Duvall, when did the penny drop? When did he decide that he had to become an actor?
Well, that never was. Actually, I was from a military family. They pushed me into acting.
They pushed you into it.
They pushed, kind of nudged and pushed. I was not doing well academically when I was in a small college in the Midwest. So as an expedient thing, I went into acting to get me through. Without, you know, it was the end of the Korean War. You know, I did go in the Army eventually, but, you know, it was like to get through college, you know, to find something that would give me a sense of worth where I got my first A, you know. It was my parents I have to thank for that.
And then you were a young actor in New York. I read that at one point you were rooming with Dustin Hoffman in New York.
Yeah, in New York, 107th Broadway. It was my brother, Maurice Stern, who was a cantor at the Riverdale Temple, Dustin Hoffman, and 2 other actors. And I was introduced to Dustin Hoffman from Gene Hackman, who lived downtown, because he and Dustin had gone to the Pasadena Playhouse together. So we all three, we piled around together and you know, talked and had our dreams and talked about our dreams and so forth, what we wanted in life and what we wanted out of our profession. And now I never see these guys. I never see these guys.
This is 1950s?
I would say 58, 60, around in there, yeah.
And were you all confident that clearly you were going to make
it? There was a certain naive confidence, a sanguine kind of thing, like we're going to make it, but we didn't know if we were going to make it. But, you know, we started out in the theater, stage actors, and we used to gather Cromwell's drugstore at 50th and I think it's 50th and 6th Avenue, and if we mentioned Brando's name once, we mentioned it 25 times in a day. He was kind of like our guy, you know, that we looked to, and we had our dreams and our aspirations, and I guess we were confident.
For younger listeners who caught movies with Brando when he was appearing rarely as an older actor, it's hard sometimes for them to figure out what Brando meant to actors and to acting in the 1950s.
Well, I think he was kind of like a revolutionary example. He presented a certain kind of realism that was very startling, and you'd never seen it before. I mean, he was willing to do nothing. And I've come to some people say, "What do you have any theories on acting?" And I said, "Well, maybe. I think you can start with zero and end with zero. You don't have to get anywhere. You don't have to go for the result." And I think Brando kind of showed that to people as a young actor. And then he got jaded and didn't like acting. And you know, people went after him and criticized him. But when you really looked at his work, he was very startling in what he could do in a realistic way.
Now, Bob, as I understand it, you interviewed Robert Duvall.
I did quite a few years ago, actually. And he's a charmer. He's just amazing. He was talking, actually, when I was talking to him about Brando, and did an amazing Brando impression.
Now, everybody has a Marlon Brando impression.
I'm afraid I don't. He was fantastic. The audience was howling. This was in front of about 2,000 people, and the audience was just howling. He got a lot of laughs, actually. You don't think of him as a comedian that much, but there was a point at the very beginning when I said to him, you know, in your first role as Boo Radley, you were amazing. I mean, we absolutely knew what you were feeling, and you did it all without any lines. And he said, well, I had a line, but they cut it. And it got a huge laugh. It was kind of wonderful. And I thought, oh, well, that's nice. So after that, the interview went swimmingly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Somebody else who gets laughs is Samantha Bee on The Daily Show. Most senior correspondent Samantha Bee conducts interviews with a range of hapless subjects and often gets them to say things that they are likely to later regret. In her new memoir, I Know I Am, But What Are You?, Bee details her journey from young Canadian comic to correspondent for The Daily Show, which she joined in 2003. She spoke with Fresh Air's Terry Gross about her background, her book, and a notorious visit she made to the Republican National Convention.
The main purpose of the piece was to get all of those people to say the word choice. It was like they had...
Well, I should stop here and say... This was right after Sarah Palin had given her address at the convention, and people at this point knew that her daughter was pregnant and that her daughter had decided to carry to term. I mean, there's absolutely no question of abortion here.
They kept talking about making a choice to, you know, in their case, you know, in her case, to keep the baby. When really all they really seemed to be planning to do was take away everybody's choice and not make it a choice at all. So choice became this key word, you know, in all of their speeches and directives and internal memos and things. It seemed like they were trying to eradicate the word completely because we couldn't get people to say it. We just couldn't get people to say it. They just kind of went around and around and around and around and around without saying it. So we interviewed so many people, and they just wouldn't say the word choice.
So in this excerpt, Samantha Bee is interviewing several people, trying to get them to say the word choice.
She said no. It's a human being.
She made the, I'm sorry, what is...
She made
the decision. The decision. There's another word I'm looking for. It rhymes with... I think it rhymes with voice. Every family and every woman should have the right to... I'm sorry. What's the word I'm looking for? It's her family. It's her... Oh, God, what is the word? What is the word I'm looking for? It's like an alternative, or if you have two things. You be Sarah Palin, and I'll be her 17-year-old daughter.
Bristol, you know, you and I have always been able to openly discuss things.
What do you want to talk to me about? I'm too busy right now, Mom. Can you get out of my room?
It's like when you have a lot of options and you have to select one. What's the word I'm looking for? What is the word?
Adoption is one.
No, there's a specific word I'm looking for.
I'm sure the family will be able to make the best decision for them.
But they'll have the freedom to make that decision.
Well, yes, but I don't think that the... I don't think that the decision, I think it should be not, I think that the family decision would become as how, yes, okay.
It's, you know, when you have like an alternative, what's the word I'm looking for? Alternative?
A different choice?
Choice, yes, exactly. Every family, every person should have the choice to decide what's best for them.
So what did you tell them? Like, each of those people who you interviewed, did you say, I'm with The Daily Show, it's a comedy show, we're doing, you know, how did you say who you were and what the point of the interview was?
Well, that's what we, you know, when it's something like that and we're at a convention and we're just talking to people, you know, quickly, we're just grabbing person after person to see if they'll talk to us. We always tell them where we're from. And we don't necessarily tell them, we don't tell them the questions that we're going to ask them.
Do you say Comedy Central or do you just say The Daily Show? Comedy Central.
Of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yes, they know where we come from. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that they know the show. Many of them know the reputation of the show, not the show specifically. They don't necessarily watch it.
You can hear the full interview with Samantha Bee at npr.org/culturetopia. Once upon a time, a fresh-faced guitar player named Kevin Eubanks swore his allegiance to host Jay Leno as the new leader of the Tonight Show band.
Do you, Kevin Eubanks, solemnly swear to uphold the fine tradition of the Tonight Show band?
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you swear to be 25 minutes late for every rehearsal?
I'll try.
Do you swear to fidget and make noise during the monologue like they normally do?
I'll try, yes.
And do you swear to continue to play songs that no one but the band has ever heard of? Okay. By the power vested in me, I now pronounce you leader of the Tonight Show Band. Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Eubanks!
Eubanks spent the next 15 years as Leno's musical director and sidekick in a run that ended last week. Kevin Eubanks now plans to tour and record and teach. Neil Conan recently spoke with Eubanks about his role leading the Tonight Show Band and what he plans to do next.
Can you give us some insight on what a musical director for a late-night talk show does? You're the band leader, but it must involve more than that.
Oh, yeah. The band leader, that part is somewhat the easiest part because I've been doing that for years. And all the musicians in the band, we've all been playing our instruments and playing in bands all our careers. So that part is the easy part. The difficult part is understanding the particular show you're on and how you can best contribute to that situation, which in this case would be anything from learning what songs will work best with an audience that's on spring break,
mm-hmm.
to answering your former colleagues, why aren't you playing straight-ahead jazz music on the show? To, Kevin, could you please speak with Diana Ross? She's not coming out of her dressing room, and none of us know her. And so I had to pretend like I knew her. I never knew her either. And so she just wasn't coming out. So the executive producer said, Kevin, can you talk to her? And I was like, I never met her before. Well, she won't speak to anybody else, so maybe you can. So I knock on the door, and I said, Miss Ross, I'm just a fan from since I was a kid. They sent me in here. I don't know why, but I just want your autograph, and then I'll leave you alone. And after that, she came out. And so I act like I went in there and said, oh, well, you know, I had But really, I just wanted her autograph, and that was it. And maybe she, you know, for whatever reason, she just came out after that. So you have a lot of different roles. And, of course, being able to, contribute to the monologue, which is a staple point of all late-night talk shows, and being able to be of some use during the monologue segment of the show. So you have to kind of juggle all of these hats and at the same time keep a musical presence and type of credibility, throughout all of these things that actually have nothing whatever to do with music. So it's kind of a weird situation that you kind of grow into. I don't think you hit the ground running so much as you try and learn as quickly as you can before somebody mentions the word ratings and your name
comes
in the
up.
Same sentence when it's going down. You'll never hear it when it's going up, though.
I bet not. Yeah, you got a real good cue this week.
Yeah, right.
I have to ask you, Branford Marsalis was the original, Leno's original band leader, the Tonight Show band leader, and you were in the band at that time. Mm-hmm. He decided to leave for various reasons, and you were promoted out of the band, and the band stayed the same. Now, 15 years after that, you're leaving, and I think so is everybody else.
Yeah, that's a curious thing. I just took a different approach. I just thought that the people there kind of had a feel for the place and that experience was valuable. I mean, I think it would have been much harder for me if everybody had to leave. Then I would have to start the whole acclimation scenario all over again. And so I just thought, well, let's just go with what we have and work with that. I thought it'd just be a better response.
But do you feel badly that your departure, now everybody's leaving?
I kind of understand new management coming in and bringing their team with them and all that. So there's, logic in both sides of it, whatever makes you feel more comfortable with it. Of course, you would like the people that wanted to stay to have that choice.
Mm-hmm.
But such is the way of, politics.
He didn't mention it in that particular clip, but the replacement for Kevin Eubanks is Ricky Minor, who comes from American Idol, where he was the musical director. So it's interesting to see sort of one institutional television musical director replaced by a very different one who does not come from that late night tradition, but comes from much more of a pop television kind of place where he's produced lots and lots of performances of different kinds and done lots and, directed lots of different kinds of musical performances. But the background is quite a bit different, and he's very closely associated with with American Idol for people who follow that particular show.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. It sounds to me from the outside as if it's just a lateral move, but it isn't. It's kind of a political or a potentially game-changing move for late-night television, maybe?
It is, and I think late-night is trying really hard to find ways to remain relevant and sort of plug mm-hmm. itself back into primetime and popular TV. And nobody really knows where American Idol is going at this point mm-hmm. because, you know, obviously they have some issues there. They're, you know, Simon Cowell is leaving and their ratings were down. So I don't think anybody knows exactly where that franchise stands right yeah. now. So in some ways, going to The Tonight Show might be a little more stable if maybe a little less flashy of a job.
Interesting.
It is.
The six Bach cello suites have been heard just about everywhere in movies, television shows, and commercials. But for cellist Zul Bailey, his new recording, The Six Suites for Solo Cello, is unique because he's playing a cello only 8 years younger than J.S. Bach himself. Bailey's cello was built by the renowned Venetian maker Matteo Goffriller in 1693. That means Johann Sebastian Bach was all of 8 years old when Goffriller slapped on that final layer of shellac. Bailey recently spoke with Scott Simon about his very special cello and how influential and important Bach's work was for the instrument.
Is it true that although they were written in the 1720s, the solo cello suites were more or less unknown until the 20th century?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the thing that was the most interesting to me through research, even Bach as a person, as a professional, was that he was mostly known as being an organ technician during his lifetime. He produced such massive amounts of music, and a lot of it was kind of not organized as well as it should have been, and there are stories that even some of the violin partitas and sonatas were found with meat wrapped in them in delis. And then, of course, we have Pablo Casals coming around in the late 1800s, and he essentially took what were considered warm-up exercises and or etudes, and discovered that not only were they not that, but they were probably the greatest things ever written and still written for solo cello to this day.
Let's listen, if we could, to the prelude to suite number 3 in C major, because I gather it's technically a favorite piece for cellists to finger and play. Now, for a cellist, is this, forgive the homey analogy, but is it a bit like a great race driver behind the wheel of a Maserati?
This is probably the most favorite suite for cellists to perform because, as I like to describe it, from an organ standpoint, which is probably where Bach spent most of his time, you would have all the stops out, which means all the pipes open in the key of C major. And in this one in particular, the cello just rings full throttle. Open strings covering from the top to the bottom. And also it really shows Bach's awareness of the organ, especially the middle section. You could definitely tell and feel where the pedals were used. And then you have the two manuals, left hand on one, right hand on the other, the keyboards, and the feet pumping the low bass tones out, and it all kind of combining in this swarm of sound.
Is there a section in any of the suites that's the equivalent of hitting the high note in the Star Spangled Banner? Banner, you know.
Oh, I think, though, the example you just gave is kind of a moment of with your hand in the air. The example that I would give to Bach would be where you go to that magical place inside, the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that comes to mind is the Allemande from the sixth suite. And there's something about that Allemande that does something to you spiritually. This is why musicians play Bach and feel Bach the way they do and talk in such spiritual terms. It's not about the high note. It's about the inner note that kind of exposes and expresses what's in someone's, I say soul, because I've never felt this kind of exploration of myself or why music is so important in other composers as much as Bach.
You can hear the full interview and watch Zool Bailey's Tiny Desk Concert video at nprmusic.org.
And that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Bob Mondello.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.